So again, today I'd like to speak to you about modern surgical ecosystems as models for surgical care in limited resource settings. And this was an internship research project that I did, guided by Dr. Catherine DeVries at the Center for Global Surgery at the University of Utah School of Medicine. So first let's ask, why should we even care about surgery in the first place? The WHO estimates that 11% of the global burden of disease can be treated with surgery. So if you're in an accident, you get injured, or you encounter obstetric complications, or you have a congenital malformation, surgery is oftentimes your last and best hope. But populations with the greatest burden of surgical disease have the least access to surgical services. For example, injuries, which account for 1 in 10 deaths annually worldwide, are 90% of those injuries happen in low-income countries. But the poorest third of the country of the world receives only 3.5% of the 234 million surgeries performed annually. And this is especially alarming because surgery is not just an acute intervention, it's also a preventative measure that avoids disability and loss of economic potential. So other than how to perform surgery, what do we have to know about it? We can think of surgery as a small ecosystem within the larger ecosystem of healthcare services. And because it's kind of distinct in terms of its infrastructure, personnel, and supply chain needs, it's often thought of as a luxury, and it's shortchanged on global health agendas. So in order to raise its profile, we really have to understand what it looks like on the inside and what the leverage points are, because outside of a core group of professionals who directly work in surgery, people don't really understand it. And to that end, we wanted to understand the basic structure and composition of surgical services, to understand the professional roles and responsibilities of key surgical care personnel, and to describe the common features of advanced surgical ecosystems that enhance the quality of patient care, with the goal in mind of answering this broad question: what lessons from first world surgical systems can we apply to resource limited settings to improve their surgical capacity? We began by recruiting participants from a convenient sample of surgical personnel from the Center for Global Surgery's network in Salt Lake City, Utah. And our study design consisted of two main parts, the first being shadowing on the job for extended periods, sometimes a whole day or multiple days, and then also free-form in-depth interviews where we asked open-ended questions related to their background and training that led them to their current position, the roles, responsibilities, and daily tasks associated with their jobs, what they needed to perform their job functions, the nature of any interactions they had with other surgical care personnel, barriers and facilitators to job performance, and then finally, any perspectives they may have on surgical care topics. We audio recorded and then transcribed all of the interviews, then we coded them using the framework approach, and we used Atlas TI software to generate code frequency and quotation reports to synthesize our data. We ended up with a sample of 27 participants from 7 facilities in the Salt Lake City area, and they had a spectrum of roles, including direct patient care providers, and these are people like surgeons, anesthesia providers, nurses, administrative staff, which included managers, supervisors, coordinators, and directors. Then there were sterile processing staff and clinical engineers. So what do these people do daily, and how do they relate to each other and also to the patient? So one simplified way of looking at it is first to start with the patient at the center, and this is the person who needs to have an operation. And this patient only really interacts directly with a small group of people. And those are the surgeon, the person who's trained and has the skills to perform the operation. In this country, it means that they have to have gone through medical school and then extensive years of training after that. There are nurses, not just nurses that assist in the operating room, but also nurses that take care of the patient preoperatively and postoperatively. There's an anesthesia provider, you know, the person who makes sure you don't feel pain and that you're still alive and breathing throughout the operation. And finally, a surgical tech or a surgical nurse, or otherwise known as a scrub tech or scrub nurse, and this is a person who's specially trained to assist the surgeon in the procedure. And so you see that this group of people we've probably seen them on Grey's Anatomy. They're the most visible group of people that we think of when we think of surgical care, but there's a whole cast of characters behind the scenes that make surgery possible. And this includes administrative roles, like managers and coordinators. And while their job descriptions vary from place to place, you know, they typically have staff managing roles, or they take care of scheduling, or they address workflow issues. And they're also clinical engineers. These are people who know how to maintain and repair surgical equipment, although one person I spoke to was lamenting that he was being asked to fix the VCR every week. So, you know, they have a variety of jobs they have to do. And then there are sterile processing staff who work in a department usually in the basement of the hospital, and they take care of sterilizing instruments, and they're absolutely vital because there cannot be safe surgery if the equipment is not completely sterile. And then outside of this circle of staff members, there's often directors, and again, this is a title that isn't set in stone, but usually they have a higher up view of the entire system. They take care of issues like staffing practices or best practices, and they're the interface between what goes on inside the surgical department and outside entities like regulatory agencies or professional networks. And these are this is the personnel side of the ecosystem. But we also, of course, have a physical infrastructure that they have to work in. And this has three basic parts, the first being the facilities. And these are things like the operating room, the recovery area, maybe electricity so that you can turn on the surgical lights and run your machines. There's also equipment and supplies. And this includes anesthesia monitors, surgical machines, disposable gowns and gloves. And there has to be a means of sterilization. And this could look like washers that kind of look like your home washers, washing machines that just on steroids. And then there are autoclaves that sterilize instruments at high pressure and temperatures. So all of this physical infrastructure also has to exist in a conducive environment. This is an environment that has a reliable electrical grid, and also one that has a good transportation system and safe roads so that supplies can get to the hospital and people can get to the hospital, and that the hospital can be a shelter for the surgical procedure that's going on. And outside of these tangible elements of the surgical system, our participants also pointed out a number of themes that they felt made care at their facility better, and they also felt that it helped them to do their jobs better. So first, flexibility and adaptability are important, and this is the willingness to incorporate feedback and to initiate changes in a timely manner. So it can be thought of as an attitude of, you know, that's a great suggestion, let's start doing it that way. They also felt that a culture of professional respect and equality was vital, so that there's not only an organizational hierarchy that makes things run smoothly, but that people have an equal professional voice. So a nurse should feel comfortable and kind of institutionally validated to say to the anesthesiologist, "Dr. Smith, you may have just grabbed the wrong medication. Would you mind checking again, please?" And they also pointed out the importance of a unifying ethos. So this could be a mantra that pervades the organization, such as, "The patient is our number one priority." And even though it might seem kind of trite, they actually went out of their way to mention that this is something that facilitated team decision making. And it also helped guide their own professional behavior on a day-to-day basis. So they felt that even though this seems like a little bit childish, you know, having a saying, that they were better for it. Finally, they pointed out the importance of well-developed professional networks. So this can be an organization like the APHA, or that's pronounced ISHM, if you're a sterile processing manager. So these are professional networks that you can collaborate with for mutual benefit. And it doesn't have to be an organization like the APHA. It could even be a group of hospitals who agree to pool their data so that, you know, they can do an outcome study better. and they really felt that it facilitated the penetration of best practices throughout their entire system in a more efficient way. So there are a number of limitations to the study, one being that the participants were all from the Salt Lake City area, so their views might not be generalizable to other parts of the country. And not all facility types were represented. We didn't have anybody who worked at a federally funded surgical facility. And finally, the observer effect might have been an issue, that because somebody was shadowing them, they performed their jobs a little bit differently than they would otherwise. And also, even though they were guaranteed anonymity and confidentiality, they might have felt pressure to answer questions a certain way according to organizational pressures. So if I were to sum up what we found from the study, first, surgical ecosystems vary considerably at the micro level. So on the left there is a really complex organization, and it's got multiple roles, it's highly differentiated, highly evolved. Or you could have something that looks like the thing on the right, and this is just an extreme example for illustrative purposes. But because surgical ecosystems do not look the same, it's important that we consider scalability, appropriateness, and cultural compatibility when it comes to surgical capacity strengthening initiatives. One example would be what I mentioned about a nurse being able to say to an anesthesiologist, you might have made a mistake. In some cultures, that is more difficult to implement than others. And finally, the surgical ecosystem is diverse and complex with respect to the types of professions and the areas of expertise that go into it. You know, it's not just the person who's been through medical school and knows how to use a scalpel. It's also other professionals from other fields who really take pride in their work. And I'd like to emphasize that even though in this study we made a conscious decision to work off the premise that we have things in our modern surgical ecosystems that we can apply to limited resource settings that will help them raise the standard of surgical care, this is not the only direction that that works. You know, the lessons can work the other way as well, because these people have to make the most out of the least. So moving forward with issues of, you know, affordability and efficiency at the forefront, we could probably use a tip or two from people who don't have all the luxuries that we have. So some final thoughts. Strategies for strengthening surgical capacity can help strengthen other sectors of the health system as well. There may be some unique attributes of surgery, but the things that help to build surgical capacity will also be translatable to other parts of the health system. And also, surgical capacity remains an integral part of healthcare. It's not a luxury. You know, it's an irreplaceable health intervention. And if it's neglected, it will eventually become a rate-limiting step in building a complete and robust health system. So thank you very much for your time and attention. And if you are interested in global surgery issues, I invite you to follow the Center for Global Surgery on Twitter at UUCGS. Thank you.
Thank you, that was great. We're gonna do questions after each one. So does anyone have any questions? Someone's gotta have a question. All right, thank you. And just repeat it when she...
Can you talk about how you envision these recommendations being implemented in the types of surgical cultures that you described?
How do you envision implementing these recommendations, correct? So I wouldn't say that these are necessarily direct recommendations in the sense that I'm going to take them to a policymaker and say, here, do this. I think that these are more themes and kind of concepts to guide people in creating those initiatives. So they could be something more concrete, like training anesthesia providers in a small hospital in Sierra Leone. But the important thing is mostly to keep in mind, well, does this comply with our bottom line? So if our bottom line is that we want to maintain a culture of professional respect and equality, you know, are we implementing policies that will allow us to achieve that? You know, are we creating rules that stifle the voices of people who feel that they're lower down in the hierarchy, so they're not allowed to speak to authority. Yes, Dr. Price?
So do you envision the economic impact of some of these things and how that might affect overall ability to provide improved health care for communities both locally and abroad?
So the question was about the economic impact of these on the ability to provide other health services, so the economic impact of strengthening surgical services versus other services, is that correct?
Well, just even understanding the ecosystem of the surgical services in our country, we spend 17% of our GDP on healthcare. And if we can understand the ecosystem, the way things are, then surgery ends up being a very cost-intensive area in our country. Can understand the ecosystem better and find ways to make that work better, then maybe we can actually decrease what we're spending on healthcare and use that money elsewhere. So did you ever have any kind of concept of how this might help work towards that?
Well, I definitely have heard the argument that surgery is very expensive and it's diverting resources away from other essential health services. I think that, yes, surgery is going to cost a lot, but it's not replaceable. So there are many conditions where surgery is the one and only option if you're going to have somebody recover and go back out and contribute to society. So when we look at raw cost-effective measures like, I don't know, cost per quality or cost per daily, yes, the numbers for surgery make it look like it's really expensive and perhaps not worth it if you can use, you know, $20 to provide 20 vaccinations, but you can only pay for, you know, a plastic syringe or something like that. But because I don't think that's a valid argument, because surgery is an integral part of healthcare. It does things that no other part of healthcare can. So in that sense, I don't think that the cost of surgery is an argument for not dedicating resources to it and diverting those elsewhere. I'm not sure if that answers the question. Yes, that's correct. And part of the rationale behind the study is if we strip the ecosystem down to its barest components and its most basic constituents, well, maybe we can figure out what are the bells and whistles and what is actually essential to providing this care. So I think one participant said, he was a clinical engineer, and he said, you know, these new fancy machines, I don't think it's helping us do our job better. I'm spending half an hour more to repair this thing. I don't think we've seen any measurable effects of that. So, you know, we can learn from studying the surgical ecosystem down to what it actually is versus what it appears to be, you know, the beeping machines and the, like, fancy gowns and things like that. We have to figure out what do we actually need, what can we cut out. So absolutely, studying the surgical ecosystem at a more fundamental level can help bring the cost down and make it more feasible, especially in lower resource settings. Yes?
Development of roles in the system, you know, within that system, how that might be helpful.
So what role human resources plays in facilitating surgical capacity? Well, I mean, human resources is absolutely essential. So let me go back to, So do you remember that slide with all of the different boxes in different colors? So of course, in a more evolved, advanced surgical system, there's a great amount of differentiation. So there might be somebody who exclusively looks at patient care and somebody else who just looks at staffing and implementation of best practices. And yes, human resources is vital to make sure that the lines of communication among all the sectors of this really complex surgical system are intact. And I think human resources is also critical because we need to know in a lot of places, you know, training for positions like surgeons or nurses is very scarce. So we need those people. We need to figure out what the core set of needs are in terms of competencies, right? So if we can hire a healthcare worker to do the tasks of somebody who traditionally has to go through 4 years of training, then we should absolutely do that instead of putting all of the time and resources into training somebody who really only has the degree but not necessarily any better competencies than a healthcare worker. So I'm not sure if I answered your question at all.
Thank you.
Thank you.